From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, director Jason Reitman and screenwriter Diablo Cody talk about making their film Juno. It's a comedy about a 16-year-old girl who gets pregnant, decides to have the baby, but is determined to find a worthy couple to adopt it. We'll also hear how Reitman and Cody got into films. Reitman also directed Thank You for Smoking and is the son of Ivan Reitman, who directed Ghostbusters and Meatballs. Cody got her start as a writer with a blog chronicling her experiences as a stripper. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews country singer Gene Watson's new album, In a Perfect World. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie Juno was made by my two guests, screenwriter Diablo Cody and director Jason Reitman. We're going to talk about the movie and about how they got into film. Reitman's first film was Thank You for Smoking. He's the son of Ivan Reitman, who directed the films Ghostbusters, Stripes, and Meatballs. Cody's entree into writing was through her blog, in which she chronicled her experiences as a stripper. The movie Juno stars Ellen Page as Juno, a 16-year-old who has sex one time with her friend Pauly Bleeker, played by Michael Cera. It leaves her pregnant. After planning to get an abortion, she changes her mind and decides to have the baby and find a worthy couple to adopt it. That couple is played by Jason Bateman and Jennifer Garner. New York Times film critic A.O. Scott described Juno as a heartfelt, serious comedy, a feminist, girl-powered rejoinder and complement to the movie Knocked Up. Let's hear the scene from the film in which Juno breaks the news about her condition to her father, played by J.K. Simmons, and her stepmother, played by Allison Janney.
I'm pregnant.
Oh, God.
Yeah, but I'm going to give it up for adoption, and I already found the perfect couple. They're going to pay for the medical expenses and everything, and 30-year-odd weeks, we can just pretend that this never happened.
You're pregnant?
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. And if it is any consolation, I have heartburn that is radiating to my kneecaps. And I haven't taken a dump since Wednesday morning.
I didn't even know you were sexually active.
Who is the kid?
The baby? I don't really know much about it other than, I mean, it has fingernails, allegedly.
Nails, really?
Yeah.
No, I don't, I mean, who is the father, Juno?
It's Pauly Bleeker.
Pauly Bleeker?
What?
I didn't think he had it in him.
Jason Reitman, Diablo Cody, welcome to Fresh Air. I want you to describe the character of Juno, and Diablo, I'll ask you to describe her since you created her.
I think the character of Juno is just sort of a very kind of offbeat teenage girl who has maybe a tough exterior, but inside is very vulnerable.
And why did you want to write a story where the teenager becomes pregnant at age 16, decides to have the baby but give it up for adoption?
It all came down to sort of this central image that I had in my mind of this teenage girl who was, you know, a little kind of rough around the edges and a little eccentric, sitting across from a couple who were very affluent and kind of polished. And they're essentially having to audition to adopt her baby. And to me, that was a really kind of powerful and strange image. And to me, the power dynamic at work there was really intriguing. And I could see an entire film just kind of in that exchange. And so I decided to build a whole story around that.
Jason, what interested you in the screenplay? What did you relate to in it?
You know, the first time I read the screenplay, I just thought it was hilarious. And I was actually in the midst of writing my own screenplay when I got a call from a friend saying, you have to read this new script. It's called Juno. It's about teenage pregnancy. It's spectacular. And I just found it completely original in every way. I thought these were characters I'd never seen before. They were fully fleshed out. The script had sophisticated moves. It's interesting. I didn't actually remember the story until after we finished shooting, but I have to imagine on a subconscious level this had to do with my interest in the project. When I was 12 years old, my parents decided to adopt a baby girl, my little sister. And they sat me down one day and said, Jason, tomorrow we're going to have a social worker who's going to come visit our home and evaluate whether or not we're a good enough family to adopt a child. And I remember that day, that audition day, when this woman was in our house and was asking us questions, and we were all on our best behavior. My sister and I, who normally fight, were treating each other really well that day. And I don't know, I just remember that feeling, and oddly, I feel as though Diablo and I kind of came to this project from either perspective, Diablo having grown up in a Juno McGuff-type house and me having grown up in a Mark and Vanessa Loring-type house.
You grew up in the wealthy family house that was auditioning.
Yes, well, when you see the film, there is this moment in which Juno's running up the staircase of the house of the wealthy family, and there's this series of photos of Mark and Vanessa, played by Jennifer Garner and Jason Bateman, and they're dressed in all white, white jeans with a tucked-in white turtleneck in these goofy poses, and that was taken directly from my childhood, unfortunately.
Oh, really? Your parents were wearing that series of photos?
Every year we did a series of photos. One year it was the all-white. One year it was jeans, white T-shirt, and Ray-Bans. And the third year, and this is probably the worst of them, was underwater.
That's so cool.
No, it really is not.
Now, one of the key scenes happens at it's the opening scene. It's the first thing we see, and it's the scene of Juno and her friend, played by Michael Cera, having sex. I mean, it's not a graphic scene, but we know that that's what they're doing. And Diablo, I guess I'm wondering what you see as the motivation for these two friends having a sexual relationship, because it seems like they're not really quite girlfriend and boyfriend when they do it.
I think Allison Janney's character sums it up pretty succinctly later on in the film when she says, "Kids get bored and they have intercourse. And Juno was a real dummy about it." You know, I don't know. I guess I found myself in situations like that as a teen where you're with somebody, you're young, your hormones are raging, and there's nothing on TV.
There's been several articles recently about the fact that in some films, people who don't really necessarily want to have the baby end up keeping it and rejecting the idea of abortion. And two examples would be Knocked Up and your film Juno. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about Diablo making the decision, you know, that she's not going to have an abortion, and also what you think people may or may not be reading into that.
Unfortunately for me, you know, it was a strange coincidence that there was so much sort of unplanned pregnancy material circulating this year. It's in the zeitgeist for some reason. You know, we had, like, Knocked Up, A Waitress, our film, and all of them follow a pregnancy, but that's in the service of the narrative. Certainly in Juno, she's not pregnant for political reasons. You know, we didn't intend to make a movie about teen pregnancy and the options available to people who find themselves in that situation. Not at all. You know, we just wanted to tell a personal story about maturity and relationships, and the pregnancy is just kind of motivates the story, I guess.
Jason, in both of your films, Thank You for Smoking and the new film Juno, the opening credit sequence is animated and really snappy. Can you talk about the importance of the opening credit sequence and what you like to do with them?
I've always been a fan of opening credit sequences. I'm not sure if this is because I saw too many James Bond films as a kid.
Yeah.
But, you know, I feel like they set the tone. And at some point about 15 years ago, people just stopped doing them. You know, I think it may have come from director's ego. They just liked the film to end and for it to cut to directed by so-and-so, and they got off on that. But at some point, the credit sequence started to disappear, and when it came time for Smoking, I knew I had a film in which people were going to come in and think, oh, this is going to be some sort of educational film or something like The Insider, and which is going to be heavy-handed and political, and I wanted something light. I wanted something to set the tone for exactly what we were about to walk into. So I knew these young animators from my short film days, and I asked them to do a sequence of cigarette packs that we would set to this fun song, Smoke, Smoke, Smoke That Cigarette. And they created something that was quite magical. It was lovely. It was snappy, and it did set the tone for the movie. And I fell in love with that process. And when it came time for Juno, I went back to these same guys and said, so what do you got for me this time? And they said, well, we have two ideas. The first one is quite simple. We'd go around the shooting area and we'd just take photos of abandoned furniture and put titles over them. I was like, oh, okay, what's the other idea? They said, well, it's a little more complicated. We want to take a high-speed camera that shoots about 14 frames per second, shoot Ellen at various angles walking, then print out every frame, find an old Xerox machine, take every frame, send it through the Xerox machine 5-6 times till it gets nice and cruddy, then hand-paint every frame, hand-outline, hand-cut out every frame. Then we'll scan every frame back into the computer one by one, create a stop-motion animation, and then we'll go on to creating the background with drawings and cut-out photos. It would take, you know, 7-8 months, the entire time it would take to do the movie. And I said, well, I like the second idea. That sounds really good. And they said, we were afraid you'd say that. But they were thrilled to do it. And it did. It took the entire length of the movie to make that sequence, and it arrived at our digital intermediate coloring session literally in the final hours, and they just slipped it into the film.
Aren't you lucky you liked it?
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I mean, I've been checking along the way. Yeah. But they, you know, I really believe in the idea of creating a family to make your movies with. And my producer, my cinematographer, my editor, I've known since I was in high school. The opening title guys I've known since we met at the Sundance Film Festival. And the opening title sequence for Thank You for Smoking was done in the living room of one of their mother's house. So I just believe in that idea. I think it's just as important to make films with the ones you love.
My guests are Jason Reitman, the director of the new film Juno, and Diablo Cody, the screenwriter. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Jason Reitman, who directed Juno and also directed Thank You for Smoking, and Diablo Cody, who wrote the screenplay for Juno. I'd like to ask you a few separate questions about your own background. Jason, starting with you, you know, your father, Ivan Reitman, is a director, and he directed, among other things, Ghostbusters, Meatballs. How much time did you spend on the set as a kid?
A lot. I was on a set when I was about a week or two old. I was on the set of Animal House, and since then, anytime my father was making a movie during the summer, I would spend every day on the set.
Were you afraid to become a filmmaker and follow in your father's footsteps?
Certainly. I was kind of terrified, actually. When I went to college, I went pre-med. At the time, I thought, I could never really have any success of my own as a filmmaker. I'll always be compared to my father. And even in success, I thought, oh, I'll probably be a failure. And I went pre-med under the thought, well, no one really mocks you for becoming a doctor. No one ever, you know, questions that decision. And I'm a fairly bright guy. I did very well in school, but I was not doing well as a pre-medical student. And my father came out to visit me, and he took me out to dinner, and he said, Jason, what are you doing? And I explained it to him. I explained my fears. And my fears of also being compared to, you know, I know what people presume about the children of filmmakers. I mean, they're thought to be as a kind of talentless brats with, you know, alcohol and drug problems. And I thought, well, this is just what people are going to think of me automatically going in. And I explained to him why I went pre-med. And he told me a great story, actually. He told me a story from his own childhood when he was my age at the time, when he was around 17. He had grown up in Toronto and went to Montreal at some point. And while he was there, he had discovered submarine sandwiches. And apparently they were very popular in Montreal at the time. And he came back to Toronto, and he spoke to my grandfather, and he said, Dad, I just found the greatest thing. It's these footlong sandwiches. They're called submarine sandwiches, and they're making a fortune with them out in Montreal. They got stores with lines around the block, and they're great. And will you give me the money, and let's start a sandwich shop? And my grandfather said, you know, son, I'm sure these sandwiches are very good, and if I gave you the money to open up a shop, you know, maybe we could make a lot of money. And if we did, I'd be very proud of you. But I just don't think there's enough magic in it for you. And my father instead went to college, became a music major, started a film club, and became a very successful filmmaker. And he told me the story, and he said, you know, Jason, if you became a doctor, your mother and I would be over the moon. There's no more noble a job in the world than being a doctor. But I don't think there's enough magic in it for you. I think you're a storyteller. I think you have to follow your heart. And it was really that conversation that gave me the confidence to come back to Los Angeles and take a shot at making films. And fortunately, this was the years after kind of the boom out of Sundance and the film festivals. So there was this democratic system there with which I could try to become a filmmaker. And I made a series of short films, and they progressively got better. And finally, I made one that really cracked, and it did very well. Played internationally, won many awards, and that got me the gig to write Thank You for Smoking, and it got me directing commercials.
When your father said to you that, you know, he didn't think that being a doctor had enough magic for you either, and that, you know, he knew that your heart was in storytelling, that you were a storyteller at heart, did you know that about yourself, that you were a storyteller at heart? Did you know that? Did you believe it?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a guy who's always loved telling stories. I love telling jokes. I love telling stories. And I had started making videos and things like that back in high school. I'd been writing stories and making videos. And I really, at the time, walked away from the idea of becoming a filmmaker completely out of fear.
So when it came time to make your first feature film, mm-hmm. was that fear still with you?
I had been trying to make Thank You for Smoking for about 6 years at that point. I'd been turning down a lot of broad comedies, films that I thought weren't the kind of work I wanted to be known for, and I believed wholeheartedly in Thank You for Smoking. I'd had a lot of success in my short films. I had a lot of success with my commercials, and at that point, I was so desperate to make the movie that, I don't think I had the wherewithal to be scared. There was a certain amount of fear of directing prominent actors for the first time. You know, I had gone from making commercials and short films with my friends to here I was on set with Aaron Eckhart and Robert Duvall and Maria Bello and William H. Macy and Sam Elliott and actors who had established how great they were and had, you know, many years and many films of experience. So there's something intimidating about, you know, walking on set, walking up to Robert Duvall and giving him a direction. I mean, you know, what could I possibly have to tell Robert Duvall, someone who has been not only recognized as an actor, but as a writer and a director?
So what did you tell Robert Duvall?
You know, this is what happens. At first, you're scared, and you think, there's nothing I'll be able to do today. I'll just say action and cut. And you watch a take, and you get an idea. You know what would be nice is if you tried this. And then you're directing. I think directing in large part is reacting. And I'm not sure if that's blasphemy to say as a director, but I feel that in my gut, that it's not as much creation as much as you read a script, you watch a performance, you watch an edit, and you react to it. Does it work or does it not? And if it doesn't, for what reason, how can you make it work?
Are there things that you feel you learned as a director from watching your father?
The most important advice my father gave me, he called me up and he said, you know, Jason, don't worry about making a scene funnier or more dramatic. It's almost impossible. And your barometer for comedy and drama will never be as your barometer for truth. When you're watching the scene, ask yourself, does this feel honest? Because that's really your job there, to make sure it feels real. You have to trust your screenplay. You jumped onto the screenplay because you thought it was funny, you thought it moved you, and at this point, it's just a question of, are the actors being real? Listen to what they say, how they're saying it, what they're doing while they're saying it, and if anything feels inauthentic, you should jump on that.
That sounds like really good advice.
It's amazing advice, the kind of advice you wish you'd get in film school, the kind of advice that you'd think would be passed around often. But my father's the only person I've ever heard give that, and now I try to spread that as much as possible.
Has he ever been on the set with you?
You know, it's funny. He reads all my screenplays. I remember that when he read Juno, he just fell in love with it, and he said, yeah, you got to go do this. And he watches edits, and he gives me advice on that. He sometimes shows up on my set, but It proves tragic, because once he shows up on the set, it's like you can't have two directors in the same place. It's like atoms or something like that, you know? Just an explosion happens. People actually just stop listening to me. It's like they see him there, and then they see a real director, and then all of a sudden they just... It's like as if I don't exist.
I could see that being awkward. Sometimes you lose your own compass when somebody really close to you is there with a compass of their own.
I think that's a wonderful analogy.
So now your first feature-length film was Thank You for Smoking, which was adapted from the Christopher Buckley novel, a satire about spin, basically, about the tobacco PR people who sold the idea that, you know, smoking's great. And Aaron Eckhart played the person who is just like a genius of spin and PR. What interested you in that?
The first time I read Thank You for Smoking, I thought I had read a book that was written directly for me. It spoke to my sense of humor. It spoke to my politics. I really wasn't familiar with libertarian politics until I read Thank You for Smoking. I read it while I was in high school. And it just made me laugh like nothing I'd ever read. And I thought, why isn't this a movie? This is the perfect movie. And as I set out to establish what kind of director I wanted to be. I couldn't think of a better piece of material to say, this is who I am as a director. These are the kind of films I want to make. And this was very important to me because I started making short films at 19 years old. And because of that, because I was young and was doing comedy, all the work that was being sent to me was mediocre, broad romantic comedy, the kind of work I never wanted to do. So it was very important that with movie one, I say, this is who I am. And when I finally made a short film that was good enough to kind of get an agent and go after work, my agent said, so what kind of films do you want to make? And I think he meant, you know, what genre? And I said, I want to make Thank You for Smoking. And I was as specific as that. And he looked into it and he said, well, this is going to be tough. Mel Gibson owns the rights to Thank You for Smoking. He's had them for many years. They've spent a lot of money on it. And I went to meet his company and I pitched my heart out. And I actually wrote the first act of Thank You for Smoking on spec over a weekend. I just wrote 25 pages and I sent it to him and said, this is what it should be. And they agreed. They hired me for scale. And I wrote the screenplay, and then it took 5 years to make the movie.
Jason Reitman directed the new film Juno. Diablo Cody wrote it. They'll be back in the second half of the show. Here's a recording used on the soundtrack of Juno, The Velvet Underground's I'm Sticking With You. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
I'm sticking with you, 'cause I'm made out of glue. Anything that you do, I'm gonna do too. You held up a stagecoach in the rain, and I'm doing the same. Saw you hanging from a tree, and I made believe it was me.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art, now exhibiting sculptures by Martin Puryear. More at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/fresh air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Out with me, Miss Private, and we'll sail around the world.
Coming up, Juno's screenwriter, Diablo Cody, tells us about her previous profession, stripping and phone sex. We continue our conversation with Cody and director Jason Reitman. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new album by country singer Gene Watson.
Private, and we'll set something ablaze, a trail for the devil to erase. San Francisco's calling us, the Giants and Mets will play. Piazza, New York, catch your eye, you straight or are you gay? We hung about the stadium, we got no place to stay. We hung about the Tenderloin, and tenderly you tell about the saddest book you ever read. It always makes you cry, the statue's crying too, and Willie May. I love you, I have a drowning grip on your adoring face. I love you, my responsibility has found a place beside you in strong mornings in the guise of gentle words. Come wave upon me from the family, why the net absurd? You'll take care of her, I know it, you will do a better job. Maybe, but not what she deserves.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jason Reitman, the director of the new film Juno, and Diablo Cody, who wrote the screenplay. Reitman also directed the film Thank You for Smoking. Cody is also the author of a memoir chronicling her year as a stripper. Juno stars Ellen Page as a 16-year-old who gets pregnant, decides against an abortion, and looks for a worthy couple to adopt the baby. She finds the couple through an ad in the local Penny Saver. In this scene, Juno and her father, played by J.K. Simmons, make their first visit to the couple's luxurious suburban home, which is quite a contrast to the house Juno's family lives in. The would-be adoptive parents, Mark and Vanessa Loring, are played by Jason Bateman and Jennifer Garner. Vanessa opens the door and greets Juno and her father.
Hi, I'm Vanessa. You must be Juno, Mr. McGuff.
Hi.
Vanessa, Lori.
It's Vanessa, right? Is that...
Thanks for having me and my irresponsible child over to your house.
Oh, no, thank you. Thank you. Come on in. Can I take your coat or your hat?
Ah, yeah, sure, thanks. A wicked pick in the Penny Saver, by the way. Super classy, not like those people with fake woods in the background. Honestly, who do they think they're fooling?
You found us in the Penny Saver?
Hi, Mark Loring. I'm the husband.
How you doing? Mac McGuff.
Nice to meet you. Hi.
This is Gerda Rouse, our attorney.
Gerda Rouse.
Hi, nice to meet you.
And this, of course, is Juno.
Like the city in Alaska.
No.
Should we sit down and get to know one another?
Well, I thought I'd get some drinks. What would anyone like? I have Pellegrino or vitamin water or orange juice with folic
acid. Olive and Maker's Mark, please. Up.
She's kidding. Junebug has a wonderful sense of humor, just one of her many genetic gifts.
That's a scene from the new movie Juno, and my guests are the director, Jason Reitman, and the screenwriter, Diablo Cody. Diablo, I have a few questions for you about your life and how you got started writing. Well, you came from such a different background from Jason. I mean, he wanted to become independent from the family name to feel like he could make it on his own because his father was so well-known in the movie world, whereas you came from a family that had no background at all that I know of
I didn't come from a family of creative people at all. They're wonderful people and they're very warm, supportive people, but they had no interest in the arts and didn't really... attempt to cultivate that in their children.
Well, clearly from Juno, you've always been like steeped in like music and movies and pop culture of all sorts. Were you considered odd for that?
No, I mean, I've always been sort of known as sort of the go-to pop culture trivia wizard, I've always been kind of a, you know, voracious consumer of pop culture, and I definitely think that is reflected in a lot of the things that I write. You know, I think. You have to be careful not to, like, just completely overuse those kind of references, but at the same time, I think it's going to be probably a trademark of my work if they ever let me, you know, continue to write movies.
No, I read that the person who I believe is now your husband, you met them on a Beach Boys website?
Yeah, I actually am a huge Beach Boys fan, and I was just surfing the internet one day, and I found this website, like, devoted to, like, super hardcore, like, Beach Boys psychedelic surf rock geeks. And I met him there, and we wound up corresponding via email, and then I moved to Minneapolis. I'm actually divorced. Well, I'm getting divorced. But you can, you know, we can talk. It's all right. I'm actually in a phase where I'm really, really into talking about it.
Oh, I don't want to
pry
into your personal life about that. But so rather than prying into your personal life about that, I'll ask you about stripping.
Yeah, please do.
Because I should mention, if that sounds confusing to people, yeah, that Diablo Cody got her start professionally in a way as a stripper because her memoir, which preceded her screenplay for Juno, is about the time that she spent stripping.
That's what's so strange to me is of all the interesting things that I've done in my life, I never would have guessed that the stripping would be sort of the springboard to respectability.
Yeah, well, how did you end up doing that in the first place?
You know, I think I did it because I could. It had never occurred to me up until that point in my life when I was 25 that you can actually just do things. Like, even now, even in a totally sort of mundane, desexualized way, if I wanted to, I could drive my car to downtown LA after this interview and apply for a job as a waitress. And I could just do it for no reason whatsoever, just to have that experience. And, like, I think I had never realized that I could do something other than what had been prescribed to me since birth, which was basically to pursue mediocrity. So I guess some people, their way of reacting to the mundanity of a suburban existence is to reach for the stars and be really ultra ambitious. I'm the opposite. Like, you know, I sort of leapt into a moral vacuum deliberately just so I could experience that side of life.
Had you seen yourself as a performer, a dancer, or an exhibitionist before you became a stripper?
No. I mean, I'm actually a really bad dancer. I never really was much of like an entertainer. I've never really been very comfortable in my own skin. I'm not athletic. You know, I actually always felt kind of betrayed by my body because it didn't turn out the way I wanted it to. But I feel different about that now, obviously. I think it's just important to be healthy. But I guess I do recognize now that I have major exhibitionist tendencies. It kind of took stripping to reveal that, because I realized as a stripper that it wasn't so much that I wanted to be eroticized or like seduce the crowd. I liked getting a reaction from the crowd. So I would go up there and do really absurd stuff. And like looking back, it was almost like improv.
What was your specialty?
I don't really know if I had a specialty, but I would just kind of, you know, throw some unusual stuff in there. I would, you know, mock people, mock customers, which is not a good way to make money.
Verbally?
But yeah, of course.
So did stripping make you feel like humiliated or empowered or somewhere in between?
It's interesting. It's such a heady combination of both. That's what's so interesting about stripping, is because the power, the dynamic of power is constantly shifting. Sometimes you're in complete control of the guys, and sometimes they are in complete control of you. And you can both kind of toy with each other's self-esteem in equal measure. And I think it was liberating in the sense that I knew it was something that I wasn't, it was an event in my life that wasn't pre-prescribed, and I was completely in control of it, and I was making my own hours, which sounds stupid, but that was actually, as an artist and as somebody who was writing more and more at the time, it was actually really cool to have the day to myself and to be able to write. So that was empowering. But it's also kind of repulsive to have a price on your head, which is what happens when you are a stripper. You really become like a product. Physically, you become a product. Your sexuality becomes a product. And, you know, most women are not raised to believe that that is a comfortable feeling.
Since you know so much about music, what records did you dance to?
You know, I went with, like, the classics. Like, a lot of most of the girls who I worked with were younger than me. The average stripper is probably 19 or 20. I don't know if there's ever been a formal poll conducted. I was 25 or 26 at the time that I was doing it. And so I was sort of the elder statesman of this naked tribe. And I used to listen to stuff that I remembered from the 80s that I loved. You know, I would listen to Guns N' Roses, and I would listen to Motley Crue. I listened to a lot of, like, hair metal. The kind of stuff that made the whole thing seem like a party as opposed to, you know, a sort of tragic spectacle.
How did it affect how you saw your body?
Positively, which is so interesting, because you get so much rejection as a stripper that you would think it would bring your self-esteem down to, like, you know, crisis levels. But it was the opposite, because I had always been the kind of person who was, I didn't even like to change in front of my friends. I was always really self-conscious about my body, and for some reason it was having that experience where day in and day out I was completely naked on a stage in front of a group of people made me very comfortable. And I realized for the first time, you know, I had this Catholic upbringing, and I'd always been raised to believe that my body was, like, you know, this shameful, dirty instrument. And stripping, I just felt like a human being, you know, composed of flesh and blood. And that had a positive effect on my self-esteem.
You know, I guess I'm surprised to hear you talk about all the rejection that strippers face, because I always figure, like, if you're a stripper, you're a naked woman, men are coming to see naked women, they see a naked woman, they're happy to see her. Like, I guess I'm surprised to hear about rejection. I just figured,
that's, you know, and that was a surprise to me too. I actually thought, hey, these guys, you know, for instance, if you walk down the street wearing a tight-fitting sweater, a lot of the time you'll evoke appreciation from, like, a bystander. That's the real world. But in a strip club, you can be completely naked, writhing around on stage, and there can be 20 guys not looking at you. Yeah, they're looking at one of the other 20 naked women in the room. It's very interesting.
So it's a kind of relative thing.
Yes, it's completely relative.
You're always competing.
That's right, and that's what people forget. So yeah, you're not instantly appreciated just because your clothes are off. Whereas, ironically, if you were 20 feet away out on the sidewalk and you were showing, you know, a little leg, every guy would be ogling you.
No, you not only like did the pole and the stripping, you did phone sex, and you are so verbal. So the phone sex thing must have been completely different for you.
I was actually really good at phone sex. In fact, I typically fail at most jobs, but that job, when I quit, they begged me to stay, which I'm very proud of. I would just sort of make up these epic stories and invent these characters And it was sort of a natural precursor to screenwriting in a strange way. It was really a fascinating job. I kind of wish I'd done it longer now.
My guests are Diablo Cody, the screenwriter of the new film Juno, and Jason Reitman, the director of the film. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Jason Reitman, the director of the new film Juno, and Diablo Cody, who wrote the screenplay. When we left off, Diablo Cody was talking about her previous career working as a stripper. Now, your screenplay for Juno evolved out of the fact that you had a memoir about stripping, which evolved out of the fact that you had a blog about stripping, and a talent agent saw the blog and asked you what else you had written. So when you started mm-hmm. that blog, were you already interested in writing?
I had always loved to write, but I never thought of it as a realistic career choice. So I just wrote for pleasure, and I don't take rejection very well. I've become more thick-skinned now that I work in Hollywood, but I was never the type who was out there, you know, submitting my stories to journals or publishers, because honestly, it seemed like too much work, and I didn't really want to deal with the rejection. I didn't want to live the writer's life of always wondering, you know, when the next piece was going to be published. And so writing for me was just a luxurious, pleasurable exercise.
So when you decided to write a blog about stripping, how did anybody find the blog? I mean, that's what I don't understand about blogging, unless you're affiliated with a group that's well-known or your name is well-known. How do people even find you?
In my case, nobody would have found me if I hadn't started writing specifically about the sex industry. That is a topic of endless interest to people.
So people would Google various sexual words and your blog would come up?
Yeah. At the time, there were blogs out there, but there weren't as many as there were now. Like, for instance, there are many, many blogs by strippers and sex workers now. But at the time, if there were, they were sort of solicitous, or they were really more pornographic, mm-hmm. Or they were intended to drum up interest or attention in the performer in question. Put it that way. Whereas with me, it was even though I did put up, you know, provocative photos and stuff, it was quite literary. I was mostly just telling stories.
Was it hard for you to go from the stripping world to the Hollywood meeting agents kind
of
world?
No, it was wonderful. Do you know how nice that was? Like, it just was, I honestly, I felt like I had stepped into a dream, and I still feel that way. I never realized I had a hard life before until after, if that makes any sense.
Well, I want to bring Jason Reitman back into the conversation, and he directed Juno, which my guest Diablo Cody wrote. And Diablo, the question for you is, were you on the set while Jason was directing your screenplay?
Yes, I was lucky enough to be on the set, which was incredible.
Okay.
And that was Jason's decision, which is really, I really, really am grateful for that.
And Jason, I know that a lot of directors like to keep the writer off the set so that they don't interfere or that they don't feel wounded when parts of the screenplay are changed. So why did you want Diablo on the set, and how did that work out for you? Say the right thing,
there,
or else she'll insult you.
Yeah, no. Believe me, she could. She kicked my butt. So she's actually I couldn't even make it to the door without getting by her, just by the angle of the studio. So I will say the right thing. Fortunately, the right thing is the truth. I never had any pretension that Juno was my story, and I'm grateful that Diablo has been there throughout the entire process and not didn't abandon us, because she informed us on how to make this film every day, whether it was a line of dialogue or even in one instance coming up with an entire scene on set, to the smallest of detail, to what music would Juno like. What would she have up on her wall? Is this a better bedspread for Juno? Things that, yeah, sure, I could take wild stabs at, but I'm never going to understand this character as well as Diablo does. And I was thankful to have her there. You're right. There is a longstanding case in Hollywood of writers and directors almost being in fear of each other. I think directors are always so clearly trying to establish who they were and, you know, establish their mark on a film that they're scared to have a writer on set. And I'm not sure if it's because I'm a writer-director myself and I've already done a film that I wrote, or the fact that Diablo and I have kind of no ego with each other. But this was one of those relationships of perfect harmony that started from the moment we met each other.
Jason, can you give us an example of something that Diablo added on the set?
Certainly. At one point, I mentioned to Diablo, you know, we really should make mention the amount of adoption coming out of China now. And almost instantaneously, I got back the following line of dialogue. It's Juno talking to the Lorings, and she says, you know, you really should have gone to China. They're basically giving away babies like free iPods out there. They're putting them in T-shirt guns and shooting them out at stadiums. It's just the perfect line of dialogue. It was so funny, so evocative, so original, and something that I never could have come up with. I don't know a person I could have spoken to come up with that line of dialogue. It is so clearly her. And had she not been on set, we would have ended up with some goofy line like, you should have gone to China. I heard the food's great there or something.
Wouldn't have been that bad.
It would have been like that.
Well, that scene that you mentioned happens to be on the clip reel for Juno, so I can play it for our listeners. Let's hear it.
Wow, what kind of swag did you score?
Mall madness, huh?
It's just some stuff I picked up for the baby.
Wait, don't you usually get all that stuff at, like, a baby shower? Because my stepmom, she was pregnant with my little sister, and she got a million gifts, you know? But I wasn't jealous because they were all super lame.
I doubt anyone's going to throw us a shower.
Why wouldn't they throw you a baby shower?
Well, I don't think people know how to feel about the situation because it's not set in stone.
What isn't set? No. You don't think that I'm going to flake out on you?
No, I don't, Juno. We went through a situation before where it didn't work out.
Yeah, cold feet.
Oh. Should have gone to China. You know, because I hear they give away babies like free iPods. You know, they pretty much just put them in those T-shirt guns and shoot them out at sporting events.
That's a scene from the new movie Juno, and my guests are the director, Jason Reitman, and the screenwriter, Diablo Cody. Jason, you kind of grew up on your father's set. Now that you have a baby, do you plan on taking your baby with you on your sets when the baby gets a little bit older?
Yeah, my baby's actually already been on my set. Having a baby actually had an enormous impact on making this film. I can't tell you what it's like to watch my own daughter be born and then just a few months later be on a set directing Ellen Page on how to give birth to a child. So my daughter is perhaps the inspiration for me on this film. And when I was 11 days old, I was on the set of Animal House, and there's a photo. It's one of my favorite photos of myself, even though I'm only just a few weeks old. And it's my mother and father holding me on the set of Animal House, and I'm just crying. I'm freaking out in their hands, and they're trying to hold a smile. It's my dad's first real film, and my wife and I recreated that photo on the set of Juno with our baby.
Oh, God, that's so sweet.
How did you make her scream?
No, that's the thing. My daughter's a sweetheart, and she never screams.
I've never seen her cry, even.
Yeah, no, she's not her father's daughter.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Jason Reitman directed the new film Juno. Diablo Cody wrote it. Coming up, Ken Tucker reviews a new CD by Gene Watson, a country singer who had hits in the 70s and 80s. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Gene Watson is a country singer who had a strong run of hits in the late 70s and early 80s, but he hasn't been heard much since then. Now he's back with a new album called In a Perfect World. Rock critic Ken Tucker says it's more than just another comeback record.
She still wears her wedding band. I've never seen it off her hand. And she's there every day when I get home. She still kisses me goodnight, but when I look into her eyes, I know that she's already gone.
There's an entire generation of country singers who stand on the verge of institutional extinction. While the current marketplace anoints American Idol contestants as country superstars and pays lip service to well-known greats like George Jones and Dolly Parton, there are many singers from the 70s and 80s whose reputations got lost in the transition from LPs to CDs and the iPod. These singers got a few wrinkles, perhaps, and put on a bit of well-deserved middle-aged weight, and thus lost out on the industry's youth obsession. Whatever the reasons, count among the lost Gene Watson. But now, he's lost and found.
You make my eyes run over all the time. You're happy when I'm out of my mind. You don't love me, but you won't let me be. Don't you ever get tired of hurting me.
That's from Gene Watson's fine new album, In a Perfect World, demonstrating that he still has the pipes to deliver a subtle honky-tonk lament. Watson had his first hit singles in the late 70s, songs like 14 Karat Mind and Sometimes I Get Lucky and Forget. Born in Palestine, Texas, he worked in an auto body repair shop until his career took off, and he was never a pretty boy crooner. His voice still has a chipped metallic edge, as hard as the cars he used to work on.
In a perfect world, I'd never wake up dragging. There's no doubt I'd still be on the wagon. I'd be out on the highway, on my way to the job. At bedtime, I'd still say a prayer to God.
On In a Perfect World, guest stars appear such as Mark Chestnut, Vince Gill, and on the title track I just played, Joe Nichols. Mostly they sing backup choruses rather than proper duets, avoiding the usual business strategy. Pair up the 60-something guy with a few younger bucks and hope country radio will play the senior citizen's music. One exception to this is a finely detailed duet with Rhonda Vincent on the George Jones, Tammy Wynette hit, Together Again.
Together again. My tears have stopped falling. The long, lonely nights are now at an end. The key to my heart you hold.
and nothing else matters. We're together again.
I referred earlier to a lost generation of country singers, guys, mostly guys, who weren't cool outlaws or crossover singer-songwriters. Who now listens to the likes of Mo Bandy or Gary Stewart or Don Williams? All the more reason to revel in the work of a contemporary of theirs like Gene Watson. He complicates the cliche that you can't go home again by going home and finding that too often idealized place. He knows what a love-filled paradise and a tension-fraught battlefield home can be.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed In a Perfect World by Gene Watson. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Jonathan Menjivar directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Today I started loving you again. I'm right back where I've really always been. I got over you just long enough to let my heart ache. Then today I started loving you again. What a fool I was to think I could get by with only these few minutes.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Lord John and the Hand of Devils, an adventure by Diana Gabaldon, author of the Outlander novels. From the Pew Charitable Trusts, working to rebuild fisheries and preserve the coastal communities of the United States at pewtrusts.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. This is NPR. National Public Radio.
The 1991 documentary Heart of Darkness, about the tortuous and chaotic filming of Francis Ford Coppola's Apocalypse Now, has been released on DVD for the first time. On the next Fresh Air, a conversation with the documentary's director, Eleanor Coppola, who is also Francis's wife. Join us for the next Fresh Air.